You're listening to a podcast from 702.
My name is Pimelo Mudine-Roy on 702. And at this time on Sundays, what we do is to have our profile interview. And I have in studio with me none other than Mandalanga. It's difficult for me to quantify or at least define you in one word because I think you may have chosen one particular title over many others that I think many of us want to talk about. And I think lately you refer to yourself as an author.
Yes, I prefer to be known as an author, as a writer.
Just an author.
Yes.
Oh, no. We're not going to allow that to happen. We're not going to. Thank you so much for coming in on a Sunday to talk
Thanks
to
for
us.
The invite, Pimelo.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. You know, one wants to try and focus on perhaps the part that you've just spoken about, the author bit in profiling you. But you've got such an illustrious life, and I think it talks to the layeredness of many of us in this country and the depth of our history and also our heritage that you cannot but focus on one element of one's life. I do want us to talk, though, about your love of books. This is something that was cultivated at home.
Loving books for me started when I was very young, growing up in Mayville in Devon.
Yes.
Our house was, full of books, but I gravitated towards comics because at that time I wanted to draw comics, to do the cartoon strips like Mickey Mouse and some of the action comics like Big Ben Bolt. But there was a lot of reading that was going on. My brothers and my sister were people that had books, and then I also would peek into that, yeah. Mm.
But your brothers also exposed you to books that you were not actually supposed to be looking at, right? That's kind of how we started this very interesting journey into your life and the struggle.
My brother Ben, the one who got killed sometime in 1984, was somehow able to procure books that were deemed inappropriate by the government of the day.
Mm.
And so I was able to come across very early in the hour people like James Baldwin, Nikki Giovanni, and a host of other writers, including the banned political writings of the time.
Mm. It wasn't only books. It was all kinds of other influences, you know, radio. You were able to get access, obviously, from the influence of your brother you've just mentioned, Ben.
Mm.
At what point did you feel the necessity to act, to move? I know that you were surrounded with this literature and hearing this, and obviously by also people in your family who were agitated about what was happening in the country, and obviously being a South African yourself.
Mm.
But when were you personally moved to act?
One of the things that used to happen was when the security police, who were called Special Branch then, when they used to come visiting to our house, they would act in the most inappropriate manner.
Mm.
And I think for any child, if there's one thing you don't want to see, it is the effect of the terror of someone else on your parents.
Mm.
And so I could see that on the face of my father, although he was a minister of religion, very, very well respected around. But here were these men who were really inappropriately behaving towards us, towards the family, kicking down doors and so on and so forth. And so I thought at that time that there must be a way. In fact, I had to be restrained as a kid because I think I was a lot more hot-blooded than I am now. I had to be restrained from, you know, verbally attacking or even physically attacking some of the people. So in essence, what happened then was all that energy, all that anger got to be sublimated into, I think, political activism, and my expressions then came through the writing first of poetry when I was very young.
I must imagine that it's the same kind of thing that Mamwini used to express in the conflict of values, where as a young person, where you have the respect of your father, for instance, who is a man of the cloth, who has given you certain values, and then suddenly is treated as a criminal, the opposite of what you expect your father to be seen as. Conflicting and quite confusing for a young person growing up in a home like that.
Mm. Absolutely. And you see that happening a lot more. I saw that happening a lot more also when we were moved from Mayville to Chesterville, and from Chesterville to Kwamashu.
Mm.
And you found yourself dumped in a field, really, with nothing.
Mm.
And you see the effect of all this on your on your father, especially all the broken furniture.
Mm.
And then you start knowing that there has to be a stop has to be put to all this. Mm. You know?
Well, one of the ways that I think your parents did well by the importance of education was instilled very early on, when the regime felt that we didn't deserve education, and you, in, even though you were a very big family, there was this culture of let's educate ourselves.
Mm. I was lucky because the books exposed me to a brand new world, or a host of worlds that I had never encountered.
Mm.
And I knew that what was going on in those worlds was much, much, much more refined, much better than what the pabulum, you know, the fare that we were being given under the auspices of Bantu education.
Mm.
And so we got together, groups of our of us, and went into bookstores, various bookstores in Devon, and through various means, legal and illegal, then we were able to procure books which we used to educate ourselves.
Mm.
But the kicker, the funny thing in this story is that the books that we picked, that we used, that we educated ourselves with, were sometimes the very books when the security branch came to our house to search, they would find those books. And then 2-3 weeks later, a month later, you'd find those books gazetted as objectionable.
Because of you.
Because of us. So we were the scouts.
You were the scouts. Look, I mean, obviously, it didn't go down well, and you tried to leave the country, and you spent subsequently 101 days in prison. Take us through that time in prison.
We were a friend of mine, a very, very good artist, James Muleya. We wanted to leave South Africa.
Mm.
We had a host of other young people were with us. The irony is that we actually showed these young people how to cross the border from...
And you couldn't do it?
Then we thought that, okay, fine, we've done this so many times, let us do it ourselves.
Yes.
And then that's when I got arrested. I was arrested in Zirast, Dinokana, and I spent that 101 days. But I was lucky in the sense that I was arrested on a charge, on a criminal charge, of wanting to leave the country illegally.
Mm.
And so my brother Pius, who was a lawyer then, got another lawyer to act for me, and I was convicted, given a suspended sentence.
Mm.
And I had to report to the police station in Kwamashu every day between 7 and 10 in the evening, up until it became quite clear then that I was also being... Very much seen as a person who's going to be picked up for a longer sentence.
For a different charge. You subsequently moved and you were in Botswana and so on. What I found really interesting, and that's around 1976, what I found interesting at that time, so South Africa was agitating for change, young people were doing all of that. But I was fascinated by the foresight even then to, in this movement, the ANC, to put together what was a cultural movement. I find that absolutely heartwarming, because there must have been foresight to understand that along with political activism lives, the sense of culture is just as important as a means of protest. And you were at the forefront of that.
We were there. We were very lucky to meet up with Jonas Kwangwa.
Yes.
In Gaborone in Botswana.
Mm.
And he put together a troupe of musicians and poets and writers and dancers. And we went to Nigeria.
Yes, I remember that festival. Was it Amandla where you started?
That's where Amandla started.
Yes.
We went as to Festac as an ANC contingent.
Yes.
I was with Lififi Tladi, the musician. And we managed to meet an extremely huge number of South Africans who had just left also in 1976.
Is that where you met Brawili?
That's where I met
Nigeria.
Brawili.
Yeah.
I met him in Tanzania.
In Tanzania, okay.
Yes, that was one phenomenal time, yes.
Am I right in saying that the thing that really attracted you to him was his bookshelf in his home?
Yes, I'd never come across such an impressive amount of books, also from a black person. Yes. I thought that this was just, yeah. So, in fact, that almost broke my route to Nigeria because
wow.
I was just stuck in that library, just reading.
He was a professor at the time.
He was a professor at the University of Dar es Salaam.
Yes. You obviously had a very lovely camaraderie. There something brewed there, something started there that was quite,
it was a lifelong relationship, really, a friendship and a mentorship because, you know, we mistake people for being people, whereas people are themselves a treasury. They are an archive. They are a library. Mm. And that's what I came across with Brawili. Mm. I learned so much from him. Mm. And he was humble enough to say to people that he also learned a lot from younger people like mm-hmm. ourselves.
So let's go back to Amandla and the importance of putting that together. I really am fascinated by the foresight to say this is actually what needs to be done by the movement. Your take on how critical that was for the movement?
You know, it's very easy for a political movement to proselytize, to get people to join, to get international solidarity using language, using words, using all sorts of things. Mm. But it's only when you use something that cuts straight to the emotion of people that you are able to get across. That's when, for instance, I'll give you an example. In Nigeria, when the young students from Soweto were performing their skit of being shot at by the police in June 16, I was seated next to a very big, burly Nigerian policeman with all the paraphernalia mm-hmm. of war, guns and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. When those kids started doing what they were doing on stage, this guy next to me broke down. And I could see that I related this story to Prajonas, and he saw that what he was doing, what everyone was involved in, was much bigger than we even ourselves thought. And so that's how I think, that's where you're right. The ANC had a lot of foresight, insight in looking at culture and understanding its political imperative.
But I mean, at that time, we had quite a hero in the leader at the ANC at the helm at the time.
Oh, we had a phenomenal person. Yeah. We had Oliver Tambo, who is one person that has done, I think he's the most important person to have ever been at the leadership at the helm of the ANC.
Jonas Gwangwa speaks of how you guys would be sent to camps, for instance, and to just allow space for creativity, allow space even within very difficult conditions and environments where cadres would be able to, I suppose, take second wind from cultural exchanges, which I think gave a lot of relief to guys out there who missed home and so on.
There was a very beautiful ritual in the camps of the ANC. I was in one in Angola, in Kakulama, and also in a place called Malanje, where every night between 7 and 8, there used to be what is known as the jazz hour, where people just sing all these liberation songs and dance, and someone will break out with a poem.
Sure.
That kind of activity has got a number of elements to it, or what it does to people. It releases energy. It also makes people keep on being attuned to what made them leave home. And so culture and cultural activism has always been a part of political activism in the ANC.
Your relationship, I imagine, with the movement, the ANC movement, which I suppose became a big part of your life and a big part of your family's life, I don't know how it would sit with me. I don't know, and I'm going to ask you this because it's your personal experience, is you have this movement that you dedicate your life to with family and so on. Within the movement, things go wrong, right? And I imagine that when you go into this war, you believe that there's only one, at the time, there's only one enemy, and you're all gunning for the same enemy. I don't imagine for 1 minute that you would have dreamt up the outcome of what happened in your family, where the pain came from within, and the loss of your brother was part of the instances I'm talking about.
Mm. Well, one of the things I've kept on doing is to write.
Mm.
And in the writing, I'm also trying to deal with the complexity of a political movement. If you look at books like Mayombe by Pepe Taylor, you come across some of the circumstances where the internal betrayals happen.
Mm.
Because to look at a political movement and see it as one monolithic entity is a mistake. In the killing of my brother, which, of course, much later the ANC did admit to the TRC, it gave me another layer, another dimension of understanding not only the complexity of the political movement, but also of understanding my own complexity as a human being, my own understanding of what it is that I was set out to do as a cadre of the ANC. One of the people that was involved in the killing actually had been part of my platoon.
I believe so.
He came from my township, Kwamashu.
Mm.
And so there were a number of layers to this pain. But at the bottom of it all, or at the top of it all, was the pristine and clear, crystal clear understanding that there will be such circumstances. There will be aberrations to the norm. There will be those comrades who come in. Oliver Tambo speaks of people that come in as sheep in wolf's clothing. And so this was one of those cases.
I suppose what it also does, in a way, and I think I see this in some of your poetry, is the fact that you then start to understand that the movement, or any organization for that matter, whether it's in sport, whatever it is, in itself is composed of people who themselves are very complex beings.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Who can love, who can hate, who can do all sorts of things. And that does not remove from them the fact that they may still be in one unit.
Absolutely.
Proposing to be fighting for the same thing.
Mm.
And does that make you be more understanding of how the movement itself is structured? Do you find that you are more forgiving of the, I don't know if it's mistakes, of the problems or issues that arise in the movement because you understand the complexities of people?
Mm. I might be understanding of the problems. I might be understanding of the foibles and the, you know, quirks of human beings. There might even be things that I'm willing to forgive, but I will never let people off the hook when it comes to making mistakes which they have been alerted to. If it's a mistake that is a mistake, let's say you step on a landmine, that's a mistake.
Mm.
But if you put a landmine in a place where you know children are going to pass, that's not a mistake, that's slaughter. And so in those circumstances, I make a differentiation between what is volition and what is circumstance.
So to what extent, for instance, do you hold the movement accountable for honoring mistakes like this? So if we call it a mistake...
Mm-hmm.
And we're probably calling it a mistake because we are now talking about the movement, not of the individual.
Mm.
To what extent do you hold the movement accountable for then supporting those who are at the wrong end of the stick and those who have been the victims of these mistakes?
I think it's imperative upon all of us. It's imperative upon me to keep on pointing out those mistakes that the movement is committing.
Mm.
That is why, for instance, you find in the ANC today, there was, during that whole 10-year rule that ended just recently,
there
was a beginning, an upsurge of voices from within the ANC.
Yes.
We started to say that not in our name, we can't allow this to happen. Mm. I'm part of the 101 veterans, you know, people who said that we need to find and come out with measures to stem this cycle of wrongdoing that's happening in the name of the ANC. I think we need to recognize that somewhere along the line, organizations go through a number of cycles, number of troughs, ups and downs. But it's only when those organizations are able to have internalized in them possibilities to remedy some of these wrongdoings that they can survive. The ANC is at a very, even as we speak right now, is at a very, very, very dangerous, it's on the cusp of either coming across and swimming across the river or sinking. And it's up to the totality of the membership of the ANC right now to see that it's you know, its feet is at the edge of an abyss.
You've been privy enough to witness the ANC through its few journeys, personally. You know, we obviously know history, but then personally, from your own personal account, you've been privy enough to see the ANC grow as a movement when it was at its most strongest and when it battled in the 80s and 89 kind of era. And that was, I'm sure, a very critical time because so much around the movement was changing. The world around the movement was changing. We obviously had our own particular history, but the world was changing, particularly the world that was supporting us was changing so drastically. And the ANC survived. We are now talking about an era now where the ANC is also going through a particular era in its lifespan. Are you optimistic about this particular era?
I'm very optimistic. I'll tell you why. Because what has happened or what was happening in the last 10 years or so was an erosion of some of the most important, how to say, the building blocks to support democracy. And democracy is all that we're all about. It's something that we wake up in the morning thinking about and we go to bed late at night also thinking about. It's ingrained in our dreams. And so when this democracy was under attack from within the ANC itself, from within its own structures, it is the survival of those elements within which the ANC itself created, you know, through the constitution, which have, you know, stayed intact, which have called to account some of the perpetrators of this violation of the creed of the ANC itself. And so I am optimistic. I'm optimistic because I believe that the totality of our people, much as they might be in trouble, can see whence the trouble comes, you know, and they have an idea that now there is an atmosphere of hope, of optimism. People are beginning to think that certain things are possible. We come from, this time reminds me of the time when the ANC was pushed out of the front areas in the 1980s with the Nkomati Accord, with the mutiny in Angola, when there was no hope whatsoever. This country was caught up in a series of states of emergency. But still, because of the leadership of the time, and I'm beginning to see an upsurgence of a new leadership that is more attuned to charting the way forward than, you know, sitting on its laurels.
I want you to think about this because I do want you to think about it before you respond, but I'm going to tell you now. I'm fascinated, really fascinated at your reverence to this movement that destroyed partly your family, your own history in your family, which was not necessarily there when the tragedy happened, the movement that was part of many of your difficult moments personally. The TRC was difficult. All of these incidences that personally affected you in, I don't think, a comforting way. And yet you speak of the ANC with such reverence. I am absolutely intrigued about that. I'd love you to think about that.